What's up, everyone? This is Justin Gordon from Vitalize Venture Capital, and welcome to Talking Venture, a show where you'll learn how to build and invest in startups, featuring interviews with startup founders and operators, angel investors and venture capitalists, as well as deep dives into a variety of aspects of the startup world from the team here at Vitalize.
On today's episode, we welcome Kai Han, the co-founder of Pallet, a startup that is building hiring tools for communities and creators. Founded in 2020, Pallet has raised $7 million in funding over two rounds. We break down how Pallet is changing the infrastructure of modern hiring and much more in this episode.
Kai, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, there's a lot to talk about with Pallet, and I've read a little bit about the story of how it started and what you guys are doing now. You can kind of see on Twitter all the people posting about job boards and everything, but I know there's a lot more depth to it than that. So to start with, how did Pallet get started, Kai?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say it was this kind of blend of fascination with the topic and then frustration with like my own experiences. So I was a senior in college, you know, in graduating in 2020, majored in economics, but had a specialization in labor economics. Conversely, at the same time, I was also the president of like the crypto society, right? So I had always this sort of interest in decentralization and these kind of distributed systems. Yeah. And just felt like the labor markets were this fascinating example of this kind of like non-singular distributed ecosystem going on. When I then went to go look for my own job, as I was looking to graduate, I just remember feeling like the entire process was 10 years behind anything else that you would do. Right? Like, it was kind of like, yep. You're meeting all these cool people on Twitter, you're spending time in these crazy forums or Slack communities, and you go look for jobs, and it's like I go to Indeed or LinkedIn and I pull up like a long list of 1,000 jobs just like randomly sorted. So to me, it was a really frustrating experience. Everyone I spoke to said the same thing, that it was also very frustrating. And I consider myself to be a bit of like a serial complainer. So like I like to complain about things. And I just remember myself complaining about this job search stuff all the time. And you know, from that kind of problem point, realized that there was, this was an issue that a lot of people faced. And so I think digging down a little bit into the rabbit hole, one of the fascinating things about recruiting that we ended up finding out was when you look at the success metrics of a talent marketplace or a talent pool, almost always past a certain size, you actually start to get negative network effects, right? Where adding additional people into the talent pool, once you hit like a critical volume, right, reduces the experience for everyone involved. And yep. I think there's a lot of reasons behind this. I would say that the most two important are that one, it becomes increasingly difficult to engage people as you're sort of starting to grow and all these people are coming to your site to find a job, but it's hard to retain them, hard to engage them. And then probably more importantly, you lose all signal when you get past a certain size, right? Like marketplace participation means nothing. And so what happens when you get to that size is like, even if let's say you've built this really curated, verticalized labor marketplace, by the time you get to 100,000, 200,000 people, you basically end up being a CRM, right? You end up being a CRM yep. of those people. And if you're ever at the point where you're just a CRM, you're going to lose to LinkedIn 100 times out of 100, right? Because LinkedIn is the best CRM of people that'll ever exist, right? I don't think anyone's going to ever do it like LinkedIn did. And so that's when I thought, like, started to think that there was interesting opportunity in the space because it was such a massive market that was known to be dead that I thought, like, for sure that there might be a model that you could crack that would be kind of suitable to taking it down. I think at this time was really when we started having this kind of Cambrian explosion of like the creator economy or online communities. We roughly just define these as like this kind of increase in digital centers of gravity, right? Like it's not like, you know, people are spending more and more time online, not for any explicit purpose, but just to find connection or make friends. And right. all of these little pockets of activity represented really, really interesting recruiting assets to us that were being sort of underutilized right now. Right. If you've got a newsletter of 70,000 product managers that read it, there's got to be a lot of companies that are recruiting product managers that might want to tap into that. So that's really how the idea started to come about. Just a mix of my own personal circumstances and I think the kind of macroeconomic conditions that started popping up.
For people who aren't really as familiar with what it is and how it works on both sides, so whether it be on the talent side or whether it be on the employer side, how does it work? How does this thing kind of operate? I'm curious from that perspective for people who are wondering as well.
Yeah. I mean, so... Right, like we take these little digital centers of gravity, these communities, whether it's a Slack community, an open source project, a newsletter, and what we try to do is build them a product that is effectively like a recruiting business in a box. And so what that means is right, like you can use Palette in order to post jobs to your audience and monetize off of posting jobs. You can use Palette, this hasn't been released yet, so, but you can also use Palette to recommend candidates to companies from your audience, right? If you're meeting people in your audience, you can say, hey, I can really recommend Justin. He's super great. You should take a look at him as a PM. And monetize off of all those transactions, right? So as the creator, let's say I'm the creator, I have this newsletter, I might charge companies $1,000 to have one of their jobs featured in my Palette and be put in my newsletter. I also might say to companies that it's $5,000 if they hire a talented individual that I recommend. So basically letting them monetize off of all sorts of recruiting transactions, whether that's distribution or like recommendations.
From that as well, so I know we had a question on Twitter. Someone's asking about like differentiation, basically, you know, you guys versus other tools, other platforms, whatever out there. What would you say about that? What makes Palette unique compared to other options available out there in the market today?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think from a sort of, there's a lot of stakeholders involved in this, right? I think on a more macro level, I would say the biggest differentiator that we have is, unlike other products, you don't need to go to the palette.xyz website to be on Palette. You simply are on Palette by existing online, right? By following people on Twitter, by reading newsletters, by engaging in Slack communities. Like, just as a result of your overall activity online, you will be on Palette in some way, shape, or form, right? Hopefully over the next 5 or 10 years. On a more specific and a more granular level, I think what you get access to is crucially sort of passive distribution for businesses, right? Like if I get a job in Lenny's newsletter, most of the people that see that job maybe aren't actively looking, but if they're inspired enough, they could go apply for it. As candidates, you get curated jobs recommended by these creators. A lot of the jobs are not paid in a given person's Palette. They're just recommending them to their audience. All the ones that are paid are personally reviewed by the creator. So there's that aspect of curation. And finally, you could actually increase your sort of efficiency and liquidity by getting sort of recommended or referred to by the creator or by the community. So it's a lot of the methods in which you engage with the platform, rather than, you know, at the end of the day, recruiting and jobs are going to be sort of showing jobs to people and showing people to companies. It's the manner in which you show those to both people.
One thing you mentioned already that we want to dive into a lot more for sure is the creators and people the running communities, running newsletters. I'm curious about how you've gone about reaching out, approaching them, who you want to work with first, who you want to work with next, because there are a ton of creators out there. There's a ton of newsletters out there. Strategically, how are you going about that? How are you deciding? How are you prioritizing that?
Yeah. I mean, so the first thing we built was the job board, right? Like to us, the product is two-pronged with like the talent board and the job board are equally important. The talent board and that sort of referral system is a little bit more complex. And so we haven't even launched that yet. We're still figuring out the exact dynamics there. But we knew we could build a really good job board really quickly. And so when we looked at the product as it was when we first were, you know, the sort of MVP of the product, the best fits for just a pure play job board are creators with a sizable enough audience of, let's say, like 50,000 plus with a defined vertical, I would say. And so we looked really for creators that had that profile. To a large extent, though, we lucked into it, right? Like we were a couple of kids out of college. We didn't have any network of any sort. One of our early angel investors, who is a guy named Brian Nichols, knows Lenny and is friends with Lenny and just pinged us saying, hey, Lenny's, you know, Lenny wants to do a job board. Can you build this for him? And it's funny, actually, at the time we were building a completely different product. So, you know, backtracking a little bit, the first stab at what we were doing with Palette was going to be to build a consumer product where we curated internally like followable packets of jobs. We'd say, hey, here's a list of 150 jobs from early stage startups backed by top tier investors. And we'd let people follow these lists of jobs. And the idea was eventually we'd open up the platform and let other people build on top of us, right? If we had a large enough user base. So we were building this product. It was going okay. We had good metrics, but hard to really grow. And Brian was like, hey, Lenny's looking for a job board. Like, thought of you guys, can you do this? And I remember hopping on the call with Lenny and I was immediately like, yes, we could do this. This is exactly what our product is set up to do. Obviously at the time we didn't. So I went back to our engineering team and got a lot of angry responses and angry looks. But we put our heads down, built the job board and shipped with Lenny. And I think we just really worked really hard to make it happen for him. And after that, you know, we started getting introduced to other creators and that sort of snowball started rolling.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that because, I mean, being opportunistic when that comes about, like, you have to be willing to pivot. Like, you have, obviously, Lenny has a massive audience. He's like one of the top Substack newsletter writers. It's like you're going to take advantage of that if you can. You have that in with him. why not? Like, why wouldn't you at that point do that? It makes total sense.
It was sort of like, you know, I saw the opportunity to kind of put the horse before the cart, right? We always wanted the end state of Pallet to be all these different creators and communities building their own recruiting products on top of us. It was just like, hey, you know, let's forget about the user product for now. Let's just go build these tools for these creators first. And we'll think about all the other stuff afterwards.
With that too, so what else is fueling the growth? I know you guys have a newsletter as well, which I've looked through that and like some of the posts you have there. Obviously, there's like Twitter and the creators themselves, I imagine, are fueling the growth. But I'm just curious, it's like what else is fueling your growth? I know you posted some numbers on Twitter at some point recently, but what's helping out the most with you guys right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of my favorite parts about the product's inherent kind of built-in growth loops is that it's cross-platform sort of naturally, right? Like a lot of creator products, I think, struggle with a thing where it's like, hey, our creator product is the end state or the black hole, right? Like, oh, you know Lenny from Twitter or whatever. And then if you go deep down enough into his sort of product stack, you get to his, tipping jar or whatever it might be. With us, inherently, anytime someone is paying Lenny to really promote a job, they're paying him for the Substack exposure or the Twitter exposure. So the company also gets shared across Twitter and Substack as a result of that. So I think a lot of it has been this bottoms up growth. We obviously write the newsletter, we do the Twitter, we have TikTok as well. and that's done in an effort to really get our brand out there and get our name out there. And also just in an effort to like, hey, like we're kind of serving creators, like we should be creating lots of content ourselves too. And really seeing eye to eye with how they operate.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that because even looking at like someone like Lee Jin, who obviously invests in the creator economy and written about it extensively, when you're in the weeds as well creating, you get a better idea of the pain points and what's like and what it actually feels like to create and the pressure to create and you know how it feels to get a response from something that goes viral. There's so many different aspects of it that you don't know if you're just kind of watching from the sidelines. But once you're in it, you do feel that a bit more. And I've noticed that too with stuff we're doing. It's like, you just get a feel for that way better. Like, oh, okay, I can understand where this tool will be really helpful. And like seeing Pallet and what you guys have done on the growth side and different use cases, like we might use it for Vitalize because we're looking at a job board for us, for instance, because we're like, you know, what's the best way to display our companies? And that's a clear use case to be able to do that. For you then too, like what is the business model behind this? How do you look at the monetization side of it as you continue to grow?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the main important thing for us is we wanted to build a product that was had a long tail, right? Like that allowed a lot of communities and a lot of creators to monetize, right? Even if you ran like a 500 person data science community on Slack, Pallet should enable you to generate serious revenue as a community, right? And so in that sense, that's where a lot of the sort of talent placement stuff becomes really important. And basically it's up to the creators to choose how they monetize. You could either monetize via placing jobs in the board, into your newsletter, tweeting about jobs. You can monetize off of a successful placement from a candidate. We leave that up to the creators and we try to make the tool as flexible as possible. And then we just take a 10% take rate. So there's a lot of people are using it for free, honestly, as just value add to their audience. And that's fine by us. You know, like if more people are seeing cool jobs and more people are getting cool jobs, like it's a win in our books.
On that note, with the jobs itself and like job postings and that side of things, like, what are you seeing that does well or what's helpful around creating a better job posting? If you have any, you know, data or numbers or things you've seen from that, because that's, you know, every startup is hiring basically, and especially fast growing. And that's a huge part of it. It's like one step is like literally like job postings and stuff. What's helpful on that side of things for you?
Yeah. We've tried to build in some tools that can add some more like dynamism, I guess, to the job post. So the sort of given curator of the Pallet can choose to set up like prompts. Right. So like Lenny, I think Lenny's prompt is why is this opportunity awesome? Someone else want to do like, how does this company support diverse talent at the earliest stages? Right. So being able to have the creator, ask questions that they know their audience will respond well to, has proven to be good. Then we also give the opportunity for the creators and the communities to add their own commentary to the jobs. So adding some of that contextual, like social proof layer, I think is good. But ultimately it really depends on what you're hiring for, I would say. Like, we ran this experiment where we were hiring an operational person. We decided to call the job title like Swiss Army Knife to see how that worked out. It was like kind of operations, chief of staffy type of role. And that actually worked really well. Like a lot of people were like, I love the title. Like I'm a Swiss Army Knife. But then it also didn't work well for other people where they're like, this is such a red flag. Like, this company doesn't know what they're doing. So ultimately, I would say it's dependent on the audience. I think we want to be able to give the creators the option to get the information out that they think their audience would value.
Tell me more about that, though, like building your own team. You're building, you know, this creator tools and everything for job postings and listings, and there's way more like the infrastructure for hiring. But on your team front, like, how has that gone for you building your own team?
Yeah, I mean, it's so the irony is never lost on me when we're like, we need help hiring. And they're like, well, you're a hiring product. But we've actually made some really great hires from the platform or from like platform adjacent stuff. So we've got a founding team of four, which is kind of on the big side. Our sort of head of marketing and content and media, I met in the second grade. So we grew up together, went to high school together. Then our co-founder who leads like business development and sales and creative partnerships, me and Alessandra, who's the guy I knew since second grade, went to high school with. And then this guy, Jake, went to college with our CTO and third co-founder, Jay Nil. But we actually found Jay Nil through a kind of Stanford entrepreneurship community where he posted a job ad in the newsletter. This was before we even had a real product going. So that was kind of cool. And then since then, you know, we scaled to about 10 people full time. Some have come from various palettes, like the Swiss Army knife. We got some seriously impressive candidates. Others came from our product back when we were building the user product. So one was called Cardea. And then a couple of candidates have come from, one has come from Twitter, and then one's come from an investor's sort of talent pool, right? Where they sort of send out a curated list of people that are open to conversations once every month.
With those hires that come, you know, after you, not the people you've met necessarily or known for so many years though, but like, what has that process been like for you? Like, what the hiring process for you actually at Palette for bringing them on board, what they go through? I'm curious as some of those like details. I also like write a newsletter on startup hiring. I'm always curious as to how founders go through that. There's so many stages of that, but what is your process like for that? And maybe what's been helpful for you and kind of streamline that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing that we found is to try to replicate as closely as possible what working with them would look like. Right. With our lead product designer, me and him like hopped on Figma for like a week together. We were just like working on stuff and pinging messages back and forth. With every person we bring onto the operations team, they'll actually come visit the office, sort of see us take calls and like build their own acquisition funnel. Obviously it's tough. Like, this is my first like real job out of college. So I don't know if we necessarily run the most standard practices. But oftentimes what we'll do is we'll take a first screen, just as a call. Like, I usually take the first call, honestly, to get them excited about the company, more so than grilling them right away. Like, I think the first call is really important to be like, this is why this thing's a rocket ship. This is why the thing's awesome. I always say at the start of the first call, I'm going to make the assumption that you're a good fit skill-wise and culture-wise, and that we're a good fit, you know, on the comp and all that type of stuff. Like, let me tell you about why this place is an awesome place to be at. Then on the second call, we start to get into the grilling, sort of figuring out like what they're really optimizing for and like what matters to them. I think to me, a lot of pieces of culture are a little bit overrated. Like, I don't think you all need to like the same things. I don't think you all need to sort of be the same way. But I think on a sort of higher level, it's important to have like similarly ambitious targets. So then we do a little bit of grilling there, seeing how they might work. And then we just try to replicate a work environment. So we actually do like paid take homes or paid like work assessments where we'll say, hey, for like a week, we'll pay you for like 10 hours worth of work. And then let's see how that works from there.
You mentioned not knowing, you know, this is your first job out of college, not knowing necessarily what standard is or whatever, which is fine. How have you built that though? Where did you look to figure out like, what the hell do we do? I'm curious.
A fair amount from just sort of mentors and angel advisors and seeing how that works. There was one, I think Alexander Wang at Scale wrote a really great article on like hire people who give a shit. We really took that to heart back when we were just like starting out initially. Just bits and pieces of content. I'm sure I would have benefited greatly from the newsletter if it was out like 9 months ago. But yeah. I'm still excited to read it all.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And there's so many nuances to that. And everyone has their own opinion on how to do it. And like every stage of the startup, there's differences. Like as you start scaling more and more, there's differences. And like I was just watching a video from a few years ago, but it's like Eric Schmidt being interviewed by Reid Hoffman from Greylock and like talking about scaling Google. Like, yeah, they're like, we were quadrupling every year. It's like, how do you scale that when you're going from, you know, you're doubling maybe, which is already hard enough. So then you're quadrupling, like what roles do people go in? And it's a whole nother ball game when you get to that point, but it is kind of something that it's the biggest part of the startup really. Yeah. I mean, obviously a product, obviously growth, but the people, that's what the company is the people. So getting that right is really important. And for you as well. So venture backed company, how was that fundraising? How did you pursue the right investors? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I generally think that like financing decisions, hiring decisions, all this type of, all these things are kind of fundamentally the same, which is like taking the signals that you have on a given asset, whether it's a company, a stock, or a person, and projecting future performance, right? So it's hoping that either their fit as an employee or the returns as a company or how much the price of the stock is going to go up are going to match the profile that you're looking for. And so, oftentimes I think it's like, really just as humans, it's like a signaling game, right? It's kind of like, hey, can we find the right signals to make an educated guess? And probably why referrals are so powerful in hiring. But when it comes to fundraising, I think it's the same, right? Like investors are just really looking for signals. And it's kind of an unfortunate reality of the world, I would say. But, as much as people talk about it on Twitter, it really is kind of like, it's a game. And you have to be able to create the right signals and the right buzz around yourself to make it seem like, they're going to be able to come in at a great and reasonable price and drive a lot of return to their fund. So like it was impossible for us to raise money until we launched with like our early creators. And then all of a sudden, like, we couldn't say no enough times to people that wanted to give us money. So I would say like, if you're in those early stages, as unfortunate as it is, and it's just a reality of the situation, like, you want to be very acutely aware of the perception around your fundraise. Is it a hot deal? Does it feel like it's going to disappear at any moment? Can investors wait for 2 months and see how things go before putting in their capital? Like, you should really make it seem like at every turn, there's barely any allocation left, whatever it might be, and you're about to close the round and you're about to explode. And so those kind of like tips and tricks, I think, were tough for me to learn as someone who was like, hey, I'm sure, investors get these kind of tricks all the time. And like, they always get told that they're oversubscribed. So like, I'm just going to be really honest and really transparent about the situation. And I remember talking to one angel who's a founder himself. And he was like, no, you got this all wrong. Like, you have to say that you're oversubscribed. You have to play these games. And I was like, well, don't investors hear that all the time? And I remember he came back to me and he was like, well, I didn't hear that from you, did I? And I was like, damn.
Good point. Yeah. Good point. Well, to that point, I mean, how did you think about that? As you mentioned, you got these creators on board and you got some more traction and, more growth with that. Strategically then, who you wanted on board and, how many of these creators did you want on board as angels versus institutional investors? Like, how did you think through that side of things as well?
Yeah.
On the fundraising front?
I mean, that was one of the main qualifications that we had when we were looking for a lead and sort of deciding on a lead, is that we already had this great roster of creators who are investing. Most of our early customers ended up being investors. And we didn't want to work with any lead at the seed stage who was going to come in and take up the whole round, right? Which quite a few institutional investors have that sort of approach. So we always maintained like, hey, any lead that we work with is going to be a relatively smaller size lead in comparison to sort of traditional norms. Getting those creators on board was really important. I think we realized that we have a lot of product left to build and we don't have a product moat yet per se. The product is good. The product's great, but I think there's so much more to build. And in the meantime, like, let's just do anything we can to provide value to these creators and to sort of be of service. Right. And so getting those creators on our cap table thus far has been a huge win for us. And I'm really happy that we took that approach. So I would say as a generality, if getting more strategics on board will actually deliver real business moat, then it's worth doing 100 times out of 100. If it's strategics on board for advice or for perspective, I'm not sure it's as important, to be honest. You really only have a couple of people that you could look to for advice. If you can get strategics on board who can genuinely provide business advantages, then they're almost always much more helpful relative to their check size.
You mentioned product moat. Dive deeper into that. Like, what do you mean by product moat? What are some things you're thinking about to actually make that happen in terms of what you do at Palette?
Yeah. I mean, so, it's obviously, we're iterating always as we go along. I'm really excited about these talent recommendations. And then I'm really, really excited about actually building sort of a network around the different communities, right? And like enabling businesses to really easily discover which communities and which creators are relevant to them. Enabling creators to refer businesses to one another, enabling creators to refer talent to one another, and sharing in that upside, right? It's like, let's say someone like Sahil recommends a candidate to Lenny's talent board and Lenny places that candidate, maybe Sahil and Lenny can split that revenue, So like, I'm excited about building in these actual yeah, I guess like network effects and rounding out the product in a complete and complete and like unified way.
One thing I'm curious about, because you obviously have all these different job boards you're creating and you have the feedback from creators on like what they want, but like, what are you seeing from actual people who want to get employed, you know, potential hires? Like, what are they looking for from this or from jobs in general, or anything you could kind of give us on that? I know we're focused on future of work and future of learning at Vitalize, and we're always kind of curious as to like what people want, because then obviously you can figure out the tools and what should be built and everything there. But like anything on that you're seeing, Kai, that would be helpful.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think the user experience is something that could use a lot of work right now. You know, we're not the best product for you if you're in full job hunt mode. I want to find a job. I want to find all the roles that are relevant to me. That's not what the product is optimized for right now. I think where we've seen the most amount of success with users is just like readers of content who have a job and are really happy at their job, but then see an opportunity that seems really cool, right? So we've had like directors of business development at really awesome companies find a role in a random newsletter, apply to it, and then move, right? Where they, when they weren't really expecting to move, which I think is valuable to like the ecosystem. But I think we could do a lot better job of making the product really, really useful for the average job seeker who's out there looking for work. Because at the end of the day, that's why we built this company in the first place and don't really want to forget about those early roots too much. So I think like building in things such that like you could save roles that you find from a various, you know, all these different job boards and all these different sort of palettes that are out there, localizing all the saved jobs in one place, maybe building like a similar kind of product, like a Substack Reader type of product, where you're actually able to run a full job search process within the platform. Definitely is on our roadmap as well.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense. And especially like who you're targeting, obviously going community by community by community, because you have these different creators on board with helping you grow the platform essentially. But then it's like, yeah, I was taking a look around and like trying to think of it from the perspective of someone looking for roles. And it's like, well, you don't necessarily have it all curated as right now, as it was super early. So there's more to be done there, which I'm sure you will do as well. As a founder, I'm curious, how are you managing your time, prioritizing? What does a day look like for you right now in this company?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So I think while I was fundraising, I spent about like 60% of my time doing fundraising stuff. Since the rounds have sort of closed up, you know, I have an actual running to-do list right now. And there's sort of four sections in the to-do list. Let me see if I can pull it up, right? So we have...
Okay, I'm going to geek out on this. Hold on. Is this all digital or is this... do you have anything pen and paper?
I just do it all on the Notes app, honestly.
Okay.
Which I know is a little old fashioned. So we have corporate admin, which I spend like, you know, 10 to 50% of my day on, right? This is stuff like accounting or health insurance or onboarding employees or, you know, making introductions. Then there's some community and like kind of sales work. Although Jake handles the bulk of that. So like I will, anytime I get introduced to a creator or community leader, if I get introduced directly, I'll take that first call because like I feel like it'd be kind of rude if I was like, hey, nice to meet you, like looping in someone else from my team. So I do a few calls a day, but then I really like to spend most of my time working on product, kind of specking out PRDs, looking at metrics. Up to this point, I've done a fair amount of design work as well, but we're about to announce our first full-time product design hire, which is really exciting because I'm not a very good designer. Beforehand, I was doing a bit of design work there as well. And then obviously recruiting, right? Like doing a lot of recruiting myself, talking to candidates, building up those relationships too. So I would say it varies. It varies day by day. I try to ideally have a split of like 60% of my time spent focused on product, 30% of my time spent focused on recruiting, and then the rest of it kind of, you know, filling in the gaps wherever needed.
I'm going to geek out on this more because this is something I think about a lot with time and time allocation. Is it a matter of you get up in the morning, you go to bed at night at a certain time? Is it depends on the workday? Do you try to stop at a certain time? Because I've talked to, you know, hundreds of founders at this point, and at different stages of their careers, they definitely approach things differently, different stages of the company too. For you right now, what does that look like? How you decide to stop working?
I mean, I basically have no life outside of work. I get to the office probably around 9 every morning, probably get back home around 9:30 or 10, and then just play video games or watch TV until I go to bed. Every once in a while, I will have like a nice burst of sort of inspirational work from like that 10 to 11 range. Like sometimes I just randomly will get an idea and start to write it down and sort of talk to people. But generally, I would say my day follows a pretty consistent pattern of like go to the office, get back home from the office, play a couple rounds of Apex Legends, go to sleep, wake up the next morning, do it again. Although I do work out. I try to work out as much as I can, just because I spend all day sitting.
When does that fit in? And what does it look like? I'm just curious.
Usually around like 4 p.m. I would say is a good time to do it. 3 or 4 hours after lunch, before like the sort of last stretch of the workday.
Yeah, I definitely have heard that from a number of people taking the afternoon break. I know Taylor Neiman from Toucan always mentioned like a morning walk at like 6 or something, like an afternoon walk. And I find the same type of thing, like getting outside or getting a break in some capacity, especially when you're working so many hours. It's just like you need that mental break, and just doing something physical can be so helpful for kind of the long-term effects of being able to continue to build and continue to do things. Because especially at the CEO level, it's like there's so many decisions to be made, things to be done, but if you're not able to operate at a high level, then everyone else suffers. Yeah. So that's a huge part of it as well.
Big time. I mean, I just even remember during that fundraising process, like I was so distracted by fundraising that it felt like, it felt like crucial parts of the business, which I should have been spending ideally more time on, I wasn't getting enough time to look at.
How long did that fundraise take? I know you just mentioned it again, but I'm curious because I've had a different perspective from a number of people.
Yeah. So it was funny because the plan was always to go do the seed round after launching with Lenny and getting traction and hype. We then had a couple of investors sort of preemptively reach out because they'd heard of us one way or another, right? We were pretty under the radar at this point. This was like April, I would say this year. April/late March. A couple investors preemptively reach out, sort of talk about doing a verbal deal or like getting excited about leading a seed round. At that point, we kind of circled up all the creators that we had worked with and been like, guys, this is happening. Like, let's get the round going. and then that sort of initial sort of VC conversation ended up fizzling out where they're like, oh, we want to actually see how the launch goes. So it was like kind of early April. At this point, we had creators lined up. So people like Packy, these people that we're really excited to work with, lined up, ready to do the round, and we had no lead. And I remember at that point, I was kind of like a little panicked. And I was like, holy shit, like we can't lose these awesome sort of strategics. Like, I'm just going to go start fundraising now. Even though I know we said we'd fundraise after the launch, like I'll just go start fundraising now. And that was like a pretty grueling kind of like, I'd say like month and a half before we ended up securing that lead. Like we got a lot of no's in the beginning. Then launched the product and then instantly had kind of like a nice bevy of options to choose from. Which is kind of funny. It was just kind of funny how it worked like that. It was like, at the end of the day, we still ended up at our original timeline that we had planned, but I just wasted all this time on the back end. I think in total, it was about like a month and a half long process. And it took another month to sort out all the legals and close the round and actually get the wires. So at that point, I wasn't spending nearly as much time on it.
Yeah, the shift definitely happens. And one thing I want to go back to, we haven't really discussed this either. We mentioned the growth side, obviously using the, leveraging creators and everyone who's using the platform as their own job boards is helpful. And I see that on Twitter and I see the growth on that. Are you doing anything paid? Are you thinking about paid promotions? Are you thinking about any paid acquisition? Like how does that, or even other organic ways? Or what's...
Not really, honestly. I think like the best thing for us would not be to really run paid acquisitions like that at this stage, at the very least. Like, I think we can do a lot in that sort of more grassroots style, like creator to creator, community to community. I was actually just talking to the team about this. Like, one of the best things that Substack did when they were growing was like, I feel like everyone knew this stat where it's like, oh my God, if you just get 1,000 paying subscribers at $10 a month, you can make 120 grand a year writing on Substack. Like, oh, I could get 1,000 paying subscribers. And so like that sort of narrative around that, I think is important to build up, help having creators that evangelize what we do and what we're up to. We're sort of much more focused on that at this current juncture. To be totally honest, like I have no paid acquisition experience either. So I don't even think it's something that we can necessarily do well. And we're growing pretty fast right now. So as of right now, I'm not thinking about it, but I'm sure at one point we'll start to experiment there.
Yeah. And just taking a gigantic step back, I looked at like LinkedIn and stuff and saw you went through Flatiron School as well.
Yes.
So how was that experience? How'd that play into building the MVP, building, the initial version of what you're going to launch with? I'm curious about all that.
Well, so Flatiron School. I guess when I was like 16 or 17, I had like my first internship experience working for this like quant fund in New York. I was born and raised in New York, so I've been in finance. So I was working at this quant fund, building and like working on these like the different trading algorithms and doing research there. At that point, the main sort of partners of the fund were like, you have to learn how to code, like, and like really build web apps and like not just like mess around in Python. So they suggested I go do it. So after my freshman year of college, went to Flatiron to sort of get a deeper look into how products are built. But honestly, after I graduated, I didn't keep up the skills, and like I'm not a very good developer at all right now. But I think it was helpful in terms of, at the very least, understanding the overall frameworks that are taken from that approach.
Yeah, I'm curious because a lot of founders right now, especially if you're aspiring or you're trying to build something, the MVP version, like you're thinking, do I use no code tools? Is it worthwhile to go through one of these coding boot camps or something like that because you have the skills? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I was starting out right now, I guess this is probably like an uncommon take at this stage. Like, I generally subscribe to this belief that unless you're building something truly far out there, I want to build a really good experience, and I want to make the experience really good. Something that I always like to tell our team in general is like, we're not a tech company. I would say we're a services company that builds software products, right? Like, people don't come to us to do their taxes. They don't come to us to follow compliance laws. Nobody needs to be using Palette at any point, right? People use Palette because they want to drive outsized value, whether it's a creator looking to monetize, whether it's a business looking to find talent, whether it's job seekers looking to find a great role. And so in that sense, in my mind, it's better to give good service. It's better to give no service than it is to deliver like a bad experience. So for us, it was important to get an MVP that was like smooth and looked really nice and kind of felt good to use. And everything that we didn't have built out there, we plugged with like actual like dedicated account managers and working with these people one-on-one and being on calls with them and being in a Slack community with them. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I think this the no-code revolution is really, really awesome. I think it wasn't the approach that we took, but it's really awesome to see so many products getting shipped at like high velocity from people that don't have like a serious technical background as well.
Yeah, and we just saw a company raise like $100 million for no-code tools. Yeah. I mean, that was it's kind of insane.
Yeah, I mean, it was a $100 million Series A, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like these round names don't mean anything anymore.
No. And that's the craziest part. Cause I remember I first like started researching and knowing more about venture capital. And it's like, oh yeah, like a Series A, maybe it's 6 million. Maybe it's like 8 million. Like, okay. 4 million, maybe. Yeah. Like, seed rounds have been huge. They get bigger and bigger. The Series A gets bigger and bigger. I know I had like Wes KO from Maven. They did like $20 million, I think, Series A. And yeah. There's they're definitely inflating, which is interesting from our perspective of how big these rounds get.
Yeah, I mean, it's also allocation and everything, because it feels like even like while the financial amount is increasing, the sort of business expectation amount is like moving, right? Like if you raise a Series A right now, I feel like 5 years ago, from what I know, I was in college, but like I feel like 5 years ago, you raise a Series A, the expectation is you're going to scale aggressively with that. And now it's almost like companies are raising Series A, like pre-product, pre-revenue. It's like, hey, take this $20 million and like figure out how your product is going to work. So, which I guess it means it's a great time to be a founder. But it is just a kind of crazy climate.
It does seem like a founder friendly environment. And it's interesting, even with some of that cash too, depending on the strategies of these companies, some of them are using that, like, yes, product and growth, but others just like acquisitions even already. And it's like, how early do they think about that? Where it's like, hey, if we just raise a lot of money, we can kind of buy out some of the competition as we think ours is better and integrate that. And it's like a whole nother way to think about raising these massive rounds. Cause then you have that as a strategy in growth, where it's like, oh, we're not going to just put in the Facebook ads and Instagram ads. We're just going to buy a couple companies and then go from there, which is just like, it's insane, man.
I mean, that, definitely there's no acquisitions on the immediate timeline for us.
Well, good to know. As we kind of wrap things up here, I just want to know, like, what is the grand vision for Palette? How big do you think this thing ends up being?
So, I mean, the grand vision is really in the next 5 to 10 years, what we feel like is our fundamental bet is that every single recruiting business that gets built, and that's a successful one, will be built as a second order function to a primary purpose of connection or content or education or whatever it might be, right? Like, I like to say like, hey, the longest standing recruiting businesses of all time are Harvard and MIT, right? Like those are the recruiting businesses that have existed for the longest period of time. And so we feel like that's going to be a trend that only exacerbates, that you're going to get more and more recruiting happening in these niche circles. And we want to be the place in which every recruiting business in the next 5 to 10 years gets built on top of our infrastructure and on top of our tools. That's the grand vision. I think ideally we have millions and millions of new mini recruiting businesses being built on top of our infrastructure. And we want to be the sort of company that supports this next kind of wave, right? The OnDecks of the world, the various crypto DAOs and Discord servers, like all of these places, anytime they look to talent, to placing people, we should be top of the mind for that.
Yeah. One of the last questions I have is just the Knicks next year. How good are the Knicks next year? Where do they get to? Never talked about before the interview.
I mean, if we could get Dame, three seed in the East.
Three seed?
If we don't get Dame, I do fear a bit of a down season. I think this team really overperformed this year. I don't, like, unless RJ takes a huge leap forward, or Obi takes a big leap forward, I worry about a down year, right? But if we do get Dame, and I believe in the heart of hearts that we're going to get Dame, three seed in the East, making it to the Eastern Conference Finals at the very least, calling it now.
And then losing to the Bucks. Okay, fine. I'm okay with that. That's fine with me. Kai, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you and learn more about Palette?
I mean, I think we're most active on Twitter. So we're PaletteHQ on Twitter. That's Palette_HQ. And then my Twitter account is HanKai1998.
Perfect. Kai, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Have a good one and thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you want to learn more about us, head on over to vitalize.vc. You can also follow us on Twitter at vitalizevc, or you can follow me on Twitter at JustinGordon212. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.